Welcome to another edition of Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. T.D. Mitchell has a lot on her mind. Fortunately for us, she shares her passion and talent for storytelling and advocacy through multi-formats. She is perhaps best known as a writer and story editor for the acclaimed Lifetime TV series Army Wives. But she's also a playwright. The world premiere of Queens for a Year opened the 2016-2017 theatrical season at Hartford Stage, which is where I saw the production. It focuses on four generations of women who served in the Marine Corps. Stories about women in the military have been noticeably absent from the public understanding. TD's award-winning scripts include A Gray Matter, In Dog Years, and Beyond the 17th Parallel, which was her first full-length play and is being adapted as a feature film. Then there's her work as a speechwriter for nonprofit and philanthropic organizations, among them the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, the Feminist Majority, the Rolex Institute. TD has been on the receiving end of numerous honors: a Women in Arts and Media Coalition Collaboration Award, a National Endowment for the Arts Artistic Excellence Grant, and she was named a finalist for the Blue Ink Playwriting. So TD, welcome and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much.
Did you always feel that you had something to say, and were you encouraged to do so?
I was certainly encouraged by my mother, who maintained a really vibrant, active social dialogue around the dinner table. I remember that I went to do calls, political calls for the DNC somewhere in Olympia, Washington. We were in a call center. I was 14 and asked if I could please do some of the calls too. And I was very, very frustrated that I was so much more up on the issues than were the people I was calling, and yet I could not vote. It seemed
and
really,
you were obviously a lot younger than the people you were calling.
Yeah, it was really unfair. Mm-hmm. I knew the stuff.
Maybe you should be running. But so that kind of was your entree into social activism or social awareness?
Social awareness, I'd say. I don't think I knew it was activism until later, until I found ways for it to be manifest somehow in my work. And a lot of those things happened by accident. I was always a lover of the theater. I've been a theater rat forever and ever. I've tried my hand at just about every aspect, technical aspect of theater making. And
while you were in school, started in...
While I was a wee little thing.
So you were exposed to plays?
Absolutely.
You went to the theater. And you grew up in Washington State, by the way?
Primarily in Washington State. Mm-hmm. And I was an incredible troll in Three Billy Goats Gruff in first grade. I just, you know, that
Funny,
clearly.
I didn't see that in your credits.
You know, there just wasn't room for everything you could.
That's true.
And besides, that was performance. It's different from what I do now.
I hear you.
So the activism and the theater dovetailed into each other in a way that I hadn't anticipated. It makes all the sense in the world now when
looking back at
what I do as a speechwriter. And what I'm doing as a speechwriter is I'm telling a story and I'm creating a moment of theater. I'm creating a moment of theater because I have to have an awareness of what is the message, what is the most important aspect of this story, who is the audience, what is it that's most important that they hear, what does a speech need to do, does it need to activate them, is it a call to action, mm-hmm. is it a call to action through fundraising.
But speech writing is often political, is it not?
Oh, yes.
So that's my point to you when I use the term social mm-hmm. activism or whatever. Were you on a political trajectory as you were going through school?
I was, in that I was fascinated by journalism, by the importance of the Fourth Estate to our democracy. So I strongly considered pursuing a journalism field. I was editor of my high school newspaper when I was a sophomore in high school, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So the idea that politics, storytelling, writing were of a piece, that was organic. That was an organic experience
for
me.
Did you know that you could write?
No. I was a closet writer for many, many years. There are occasions that I had journals, but I wasn't consistent with them. I think part of my problem with the journal is I wasn't sure who I was writing to. I couldn't write to the object of a diary. I didn't feel comfortable writing to self.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't very interested in the monologues of the first person, the I monologues. And I would play in different forms and formats. I would play in poetry format or dialogue. I would write some political personal essay. But for the most part, it was, those were things that I did for myself, for my
own
challenge.
And they were personal.
They were personal.
And not shared necessarily.
Correct.
Yes.
Correct. In fact, it was a teacher I had in Los Angeles. Her name's Claudette Sutherland. And New Yorkers know her because she is a well-known actress, was for many years. She originated the role of Smitty in How to Succeed in Business.
Uh-huh.
When she was just a wee lass, and she moved further into writing and editing herself. And it was through a friend that I was introduced to her table, as we called it. It was not a class that was associated with a university or any sort of matriculation sort of program. But she had this writing class, and a friend of mine who knew about my closet writing said, go in there and just work out around her table. And I kind of rolled my eyes. And
is this after you graduated or while?
Well, I didn't go to college.
No kidding.
I don't have an undergraduate degree, let's say. That's more exact.
I've been
to a lot of college. I've done a lot of
been on the circuit,
college
huh?
level study. I mostly pursued teachers, but financially, economically, it wasn't an option for my family. My mother had been number 12 out of 13 kids.
No kidding. Wow.
She'd grown up in abject poverty in Spokane, Washington. Thank goodness for me, she fell in love with words. She fell in love with language, and she became what she calls a print junkie. And she had just the right foster parent at just the right time.
Isn't that something?
It's a miracle is what it is.
Wow.
I feel really indebted to that foster system.
And she passed that love on to you.
She passed that love on to me. She passed on the love for writing. That said, our idea that the American dream is accessible for everyone, all you have to do is work hard and then you'll make money and then it'll, it's such a scam. It's such a scam.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's taken a couple of, it's taken a generation to get to a place where I could now afford to go to college and at least twice a year, I think, it'd be really fun to go to college.
Because why?
Because my curiosities are so vast and endless. And
mm-hmm.
So much of what I study, I'm self-taught. I've talked my way into college classes, non-credited college classes, just because I wanted to know. So going back to Claudette, the teacher I had written around her table for a few years. And I came in one day with a revised piece. I don't even know if it was personal essay or a piece of poetry. I'm not sure. And I read, as one does when we bring in revisions, read to the group. This is what I did. And there was a pause. And she said, "You can't come back to the table." I said, I beg your pardon. I team teach workshops with you now. What are you talking about? I can't come back to the table. She said, "You can't come back to the table until you're putting this work out in the world." She said, "You don't get to do this in secret anymore."
So it's time for you to go public almost.
Yeah.
And how old were you when that happened?
I was in my mid-20s, maybe.
And was that a seminal moment for you?
Well, of course, at first I thought she was joking,
mm-hmm.
giving me a hard time. But she was really serious about it. And yes, I had already done, bits and bobs that had sort of made it out into the into the world. My first short play had gone out. I had started being hired as a speechwriter. That also happened by accident. But yeah, her pushing me out of the
nest. Out the door.
And out the door and saying, you know, ta-da, this is not just sort of some hobby.
What work was she referring to?
I don't know. From her perspective, it was any of my work.
It was collective.
It was, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So why a script writer and a playwright, for example, and not an author?
I think that in writing stories about other people, of course, it's self-protective. I mean, when someone comes to see one of my plays, I may not physically be on the stage, but I feel utterly stripped naked. None of them are about me, and yet they are so deeply, deeply personal. So I think that aspect of it appeals to me, that I can be behind the camera, behind the scenes, behind the, you know, backstage, and reveal and explore in ways that are not indirect in terms of it not being my physical body there. So that's one thing about it that appealed to me. And then the theater has always been my church and my temple. It's always been my place of home and where I feel most spiritually connected through creativity.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is T.D. Mitchell, who happens to be a writer, story editor, playwright, speechwriter, and so on and so on. How do you write a play?
I'm utterly overwhelmed by the blank page when I start a new play. It's very daunting. And sometimes I think my lack of extensive university education makes it difficult for me, because it's hard for me to articulate what it is that I'm doing by instinct. Like, I don't necessarily have the technical language for what I do. What I can tell you is that I cannot write a play in a linear way. I always start somewhere in the middle. Huh. I don't even know where in the middle it is. And so I get a bunch of different scenes somewhere in the middle.
But an idea has been festering in you.
Oh, gosh.
And you have to get it out.
Usually after at least a year's worth of research. So I am definitely a research-based writer. I like to submerse myself in the culture and the language about which I'm writing. Otherwise, I think there's no authenticity and veracity to it.
But what attracts you to the topics?
The topics find me. Like I said, the curiosity is already there. But I started writing about veterans because of a conversation I had on a plane in 2003 with a Vietnam-era vet who was seated to my left. And we started a conversation, and I ended up having my mind utterly opened by this gentleman. And I stood in baggage claim, furiously taking notes on what our conversation had been, knowing I had no idea what form the story was supposed to
but
be in.
You knew, but it was going to go somewhere.
I knew it was a story that I wasn't hearing, that I wanted to be out hearing in the public sphere. This was in 2003, between the first and second UN resolutions to invade Iraq. And this gentleman seated next to me started talking about how his son was in the army, and they had so many more things to talk about now and to connect
to
on,
share.
To share in all these ways. But it also meant that with his son at that moment being stationed in Kuwait, so without him saying, without me saying, we both know that if we were invading Iraq, his son was going to be in the first round in there. And they had all these points of connection. He said, I thought I'd been through the most terrifying aspect of war as a combat veteran. I had no idea how hard it was to be the one left behind.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I wasn't hearing from people who had seen combat, who did not have the luxury of naivete, and who had family in, who were going to be on the front lines. I was not hearing from those people about how wise this invasion was or
wasn't.
Not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But 2003, where did that come for you in terms of your career? You had not certainly started Army Wives at that point.
No, actually, that play, Beyond the 17th Parallel, the play that came out of that conversation or was inspired by that conversation, that led to 3 seasons of writing on Army Wives. So I was there seasons 3, 4, and 5.
So Beyond the 17th Parallel mm-hmm. was ostensibly your first play.
It was my first full-length play. It was scheduled for production at Seattle ACT in 2007, then in 2008. Then in 2009, there were internal issues that I was not privy to, but they kept pushing the season in which it was going to be produced, and I wasn't finding out that this pushing was happening until after all the other theaters had programmed their following season, so I didn't have an opportunity to send it somewhere else. So finally, I yanked it. It's never been produced.
But how did you get into Lifetime, into the television series?
I got into the TV world because my theatrical agent at the time said, listen, I really prefer that my playwrights eat, so I'd like to pass your plays on to the TV department. They're always interested in looking at playwrights. And the TV department said, so, okay, you said you don't want to write for television, but if you did, what's interesting to you? So I turned down a lot of meetings before I started saying yes to meetings to even consider that, because I'd seen the way the TV schedule and structure could really eat up and spit out writers. I did not want to lose my love for writing. And I was fearful of that.
Oh, sure.
That was my major hesitation.
But were you grateful for the experience?
Oh, I'm absolutely grateful for the experience. It was fascinating. It was good to know that I had that particular skill set, because it's so wildly different from what I do as a playwright. Mm. It looks similar, but it's actually very, very different for me in terms of process.
So let's move to playwriting, mm-hmm. and specifically Queens for a Year.
Queens for a Year is it's a derogatory term, and it's in reference to women who are doing their overseas tour of duty. And it implies that even an ugly female gets unduly treated as special, gets to skate, gets off easy, is treated like a queen because there are so few females in an overwhelmingly male profession. Therefore, even somebody who in real life would rate low on the great Trump scale of of hotness, because there are so few females, is a female in demand. So this play is about 4 generations of female Marines. I chose the Marine Corps because it has the lowest percentage of females to males. The oldest character, the matriarch, is the great-grandmother, served in World War II, but her mother had served previously in World War I, and few people understood that there were women Marines in World War I. And the idea of that untapped kind of secret history was very appealing to me. But you do have females that have to adopt a very male, misogynistic culture and language. It is really, really reflected in the language, even as we refer to the brotherhoods. And it's only recently that we started saying our men and women in the service. So it questions the price paid by women to put themselves in that environment, and what do they have to do in order not just to succeed, but survive.
How did you know that that was an issue?
Because of the research I'd done for Beyond the 17th Parallel, because I'd interviewed all of these Vietnam-era vets. In the course of those interviews, I interviewed a few female Vietnam-era vets, and I wanted to find a way to fit them into that story. And I realized they really needed their own play. They needed their own space and their own exploration, because the female experience is so different from the male experience in the U.S. military structure and cultures. So I knew when I was writing Beyond the 17th Parallel that I wasn't done with the subject of veterans, and I knew that the women needed their own space and their own play.
why would you want to be in the Marine Corps?
Well, the females that I spoke to, of course, they've only recently gotten official combat designation. Now, obviously, in OEF and OIF, these current conflicts, women have played an important frontline role, unheralded much of the time, unacknowledged much of the time, because the thought was that the American public didn't have the stomach for females in combat or females in infantry. Now we're starting to see it formally shifting in terms of policy. But of course, yes, I interviewed many dozens of women who'd served during different eras. You know, many of them join out of a sense of familial duty. There's a history of service within the families, so it's sort of a legacy join, if you will. Many have joined because they feel the Marine Corps is the toughest and the hardest of those branches, and therefore they wanted to do whatever was the toughest and the hardest. And there's some stats that actually a fairly significant amount, I'm going to estimate, not having my notes in front of me, and say around 30% of females who joined the Marine Corps had previously experienced sexual assault or domestic violence in their families, because that could make them invincible. That could make them tough.
Wow.
And safe.
Wow.
And unfortunately, it's the reverse.
It's the reverse. If you're just joining us, my guest today is T.D. Mitchell. What's the experience like of seeing your work produced?
Hartford Stage was its first full production, premiere production. And it's amazing. It kind of, you know, makes head and heart explode with awe when you see it manifest what's been on the page for so long.
Well, it's clearly giving birth.
Yeah. Oh, God, yes. Is it ever?
What was that experience like, watching the words on paper morph into real people on stage?
It both creates a sense of excitement and
terror.
Sheer terror. Because I, of course, was doing rewriting into the while still in the production process. The only time I stopped doing rewriting was as of opening night, only because contractually I had to.
Stop!
I wasn't allowed to do any more. And during the production run, I took all sorts of notes that I'm now integrating in what I see as the next draft of the play. To me, the play continues to
evolve. Why?
Oh, yes. Because you make so many discoveries when it goes from page to stage. You make so many discoveries when you have the luxury of physical space and the dynamics of that.
And seeing it, no pun intended, being played out.
Yes.
In front of your eyes.
Indeed. And so it definitely informs the next draft.
But even having said that, how do you really feel about Queens for a Year on the stage for the first time, people coming to see your work? What is that feeling like?
It's very revealing. It's hyper-revealing of self. So in that sense, it's an incredibly vulnerable feeling.
In terms of the judgment?
I suppose that's logically where it goes, but no. The primary judgment I have about it is I want it to be the best piece it can possibly be, and the person I'm competing with or trying to please is myself.
It's you, sure.
And I am the harshest critic and the least easy to satisfy in all of that. I think what was most satisfying was having female veterans come up to me afterward, and males as well, come up to me afterward and say, there was one woman in particular, she said, I never thought I would see myself portrayed on the American stage.
So that you nailed it, that she felt you had nailed it.
For her, I did. Yeah, for her, I did. And and one of my early research interviews, a female vet who had served in 2005 in Tikrit. She flew in from Los Angeles to see the play. It was important to me that that she and other veterans who had been so generous with their stories be able to see what I had done, and I definitely wanted their stamp of approval and authenticity.
I said in the introduction that stories about women in the military, I mean, how's this for stating the obvious, have been noticeably absent from the public understanding. So clearly, you, in addition to writing something so intense, provided this amazing public service.
Well, of course, at the time that you're writing it, you don't see it as that. I mean, I don't see it as that.
Well, that's not the reason why you did it.
Right.
But that's a fallout from it. Mm-hmm. That's a positive fallout from it.
It's a not quite a happy accident, but it is definitely a positive result. I think ideally when I'm at my best as a writer, I am not answering questions. I am asking questions. And I am hopefully inspiring dialogue between families, between communities. And in general, the theater community is so, so, so far separate from the military community, the active service military communities. And it was really important to me that those two meet and mingle and discuss really difficult, uncomfortable topics. I set out to make my audience feel uncomfortable.
How amazing it must be that people are not walking out of the theater saying, so where did we park? Or do you want to go? You want to go for a drink? But that they're leaving the theater saying, "Oh my God!"
Well, nobody walks out without an opinion, and some people walk out during the show. So it is certainly it's not everybody's cup of tea. A lot of people want theater to be a passive experience
and sheer entertainment.
Sure. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that. I happen to be not very good at it, but there are people who walk in with that expectation. And so we always had people who left during intermission, and occasionally we had someone who would leave to, you know, get up during the play and walk out. And I am okay with that because I'm not out to please everyone. And in fact, asking difficult questions can be very, very confronting to an audience.
We're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you as we wrap up, would you like to move into movies?
Well, I am moving into movies in that I am doing the adaptation
of 17th Parallel.
Yes, mm-hmm. Because a director friend of mine who I respect very much suggested it because he would like to direct it. Tom Verica, who directs a lot for Shonda Rhimes, directs a lot of television and mm-hmm. is himself an actor. And so he approached me about it. People say that my plays are filmic, are cinematic. I don't go into it with that intention.
Sure.
The movies as a business right now, as a form, it's not a place for one to have high expectations or make money, frankly, mm-hmm, if you're going to do it independently, which we would prefer to do.
We could just go on and on and on, TD. But I thank you for sharing your work and your passion and your insights. I found it just so fascinating.
Thank you. I've enjoyed everything I've listened to online of the podcast.
So well, thank you.
It's a real pleasure to be here.
I really enjoyed meeting and talking to you. Thank you for coming.
Well, thank you for coming all the way to the play.
It wasn't such a big deal.
Well.
And it really is a lot of food for thought. Join us for another edition of Conversations with Creative Women, and please go to our iTunes store page and leave a rating and a review. And if you know anyone you think that we should interview, contact us at sandyclineshow.com.